From the Sky News Centre at 5, relief efforts are underway in the Caribbean to help the British territories devastated by Hurricane Irma. UK troops have managed to restore power and communications in Anguilla and clear the airport runway. They've now arrived at the British Virgin Islands, which were also badly hit. Greek captain Tim Jones from Brize Norton says they're flying three planes out there today.
It's about making sure the most important stuff gets there first, and also it's the weather factor, so there is another storm coming through the region, so we've had to weigh all these factors, make some very precise judgments.
The number of people known to have died following an earthquake in Mexico has risen to 32. It's the largest tremor to strike the country in a century and has toppled buildings. A doctor has been charged with two sexual assaults at hospitals in Oxford and Cambridge. The 26-year-old was arrested last year after a woman reported being assaulted at the John Radcliffe Hospital. He's also alleged to have attacked a woman 2 years before at Adam Brooks. The mum of a girl whose organs have helped a record-breaking 8 people hopes her story will encourage others to set out their wishes. 13-year-old Jemima Lazel died unexpectedly in 2012 from a brain aneurysm. She'd previously discussed organ donation with her parents. Her mum, Sophie, says she's very proud.
Just to know that her death had such a positive impact is incredibly important to us, to all those who knew her. We are very, very keen that people start talking about organ donation so that more people can be helped.
In sport, Manchester United boss Jose Mourinho says they voted against closing the transfer window early. Enough Premier League clubs were in favour of moving the summer deadline to before the first game of next season for it to be signed off yesterday. Normally, the window closes at the end of August. And at least 16 performances of the much-anticipated musical Hamilton in the West End have been rescheduled. The opening shows at Victoria Palace will now start on the 6th of December because of delays to renovation work there. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's 9/11 16th anniversary politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. It's a councillor and MP-free show this week. We're clearing the decks to take an in-depth look at 16 years, much of which is lies. As the war on terrorism begins to reach the age of adulthood, we know what happened on 9/11, don't we? Well, the answer is no. Most of us in the West don't. But many parts of the world, except the Western corporate media, see 9/11 as some kind of inside job, as an excuse to tear up the rulebook of international law to invade any country they like in the hunt for the terrorists. Some even say international law has been reduced now to where it was in 1930s Europe. A philosophy of might is right, backed up by wall-to-wall propaganda from mainstream press, which just amplifies the narrow views of bankers and military chiefs. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya and Syria are just the most obvious. But there's also the takeover of former Yugoslavia, most recently Montenegro by NATO, and ex-Soviet countries such as Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, and the biggest and most recent coup, nearly controlled by NATO but not quite, is Ukraine. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the latest boogeyman is President Putin. There's even whispers of trying to force regime change in Moscow. 9/11 legitimised the demonisation of Muslims too, an excuse for drones to kill freedom fighters opposing NATO occupations, in many ways like Hitler's hate campaign against the Jews in the 30s and 40s. Government policy has provided the perfect cover for racists. And on the economic side, with Gordon Brown's being bamboozled by history's greatest heist and the death of capitalism in 2008, we're limping along on imaginary money. The European Central Bank's now printing 2.5 trillion euros to prop up the zombie banks and the zombie markets. Finally, With tax-evading oligarchy replacing democracy and work no longer a route out of poverty for many, the gap is widening between the rich and the destitute. Our so-called leaders have created fertile ground for the rise of fascism and riots in the West too. Illegal wars abroad and loss of freedoms at home. Whatever happened to that peace dividend? And what part of the September the 11th, 2001 attacks played in all that? Well, to discuss this and much more, I'm joined by author Ian Henshaw. Hi, Ian. Welcome to Bristol.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about your book in the first place. What inspired you to write it?
I've been on a lot of radio shows, Tony, and they always ask what made you first suspicious. Not quite the same question, but let me tell you what. It was when I heard that after the attack on the Twin Towers and 9/11, they'd accidentally, well, by good luck, according to them, found intact the passport of one of the alleged hijackers. Now, that's very credible if you think the whole thing's some sort of setup, because they needed to sew a paper trail. But how on earth, if you believe the official story, did that passport survive the inferno of the towers, to be found in the middle of crisis hit New York, rapidly handed into the FBI and identified on the news programs that night as proof of the official story?
Well, hang on, there was an explosion, I seem to remember, when the plane hit the building. Surely the explosion could have blown the passport away so that it kind of fluttered down.
Well, that's what they said, Tony. Personally, that strikes me as unlikely, but I guess you'd have to replicate a plane blowing up to see. I think intuition suggested to me that this wasn't true.
I suppose a fireball might not necessarily leave the passport uncharred.
This passport was in such good nick, and they found another one on flight 93 as well, buried in the ground, which didn't seem to quite match the alleged hijacker, but maybe it did at a stretch. I look into all that in my book.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, this whole thing of the passport seems to have also been appearing recently, doesn't it, in many of the other attacks, including the ones on mainland Europe.
Indeed. I mean, it's astonishing how these jihadi terrorists leave their passports lying around and their identity documents, like the Kouachi brothers and Charlie Hebdo. They left their passports and identity documents in the getaway car, as you would if you're a professional terrorist.
And we also had a similar sort of thing in the Barcelona attack as well, apparently. The most recent.
Indeed, yes. In other words, there's a pattern here. 9/11 is effectively the daddy of all of these
subsequent
events.
Let's just assume for a minute that these terrorists didn't necessarily bring their passports, wouldn't think, oh, I must take my passport everywhere with me in case the police check me or something, I can prove to say who I am, and I leave my passport in my vehicles, etc. What would be the purpose of somebody planting a passport?
Well, it would have to be somebody who's, up to no good, and perhaps it indicates that there was something dodgy about the alleged hijackers. I mean, we can talk about that. In fact, there's an enormous amount that's dodgy about them, starting with the fact that at least one of them couldn't possibly have flown the plane he's supposed to have flown, and that's based on reports from the flight school he was at.
Okay, so in the most recent terrorist attacks we've seen, that many of them, particularly the ones in the run-up to the British general election, which all seem to, thank God, have stopped now. One does wonder if they had something to do with the general election, but so we had three attacks here in Britain. And all those cases, those people, the main ringleaders, were known to the authorities, known to the security services and people like MI5, many of whom had also been reported, Martin, to the anti-terror hotline.
Yes, that's right. And in actual fact, if you think about the context of 9/11, the Western intelligence services have an intimate relationship with jihadi terrorists going back to the 1980s. Operation Cyclone, the biggest undercover operation in history in terms of finance. The film with Tom Hanks in it called
Charlie Wilson's War. It's a good film, actually.
It's a very good film.
It's well worth watching.
And of course, it's made from the US perspective, where they basically boast about the fact that they created jihadi terrorism. And then, of course, the official story is that Al-Qaeda, which was created with Osama bin Laden working closely with the CIA, SAS, etc., and then he went rogue. But, of course, the story is very clear. Al-Qaeda was created by the Western intelligence services and the Saudis.
Yeah,
and nobody disputes that.
They like to make out that, it all stopped in 1993 or something when they moved out of Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, they said, oh, this was such a shock, we lost interest in Afghanistan. It's a bit like a drug dealer saying they lost their address book. Of course, that's not true. It's obviously not true. But the proof has now arisen in that, that the Osama bin Laden unit was discovered, leaked about 2 years after 9/11. So all through the debates that they had at the time of 9/11, when they were adamantly saying they were taken by surprise, they'd lost interest in Afghanistan, there were actually 80 CIA agents in a dedicated, top-secret Osama bin Laden unit running whatever they were running in the run-up to 9/11. Nobody even asked them, and most people don't even know the name of the guy who was in charge of it.
Now, some people listening will be thinking, how many conspiracy theories can they crash into the first 5 minutes of this programme? But look,
well, this isn't a theory. I don't say anything that's not based on official documents.
I mean, I asked you this question, but one of the things that first woke me up to the September 11th attacks was a film by a guy called Dave Von Kleist, who was a radio host over in the United States, something called The Power Hour, and he'd been sent lots of footage from the various news channels, local TV news in New York and all over the United States, and that's what the thing he asked on his radio show. And I think this is something we can learn from, is that when you see one of these big attacks, immediately switch on your recorder and start to record the TV, the radio and everything, and then make copies of it and send it in to journalists so that we can pull things apart, because the government certainly isn't doing it. And here is Dave Von Kleist, because I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago and just asked him about this whole idea of as he was accused all the time of being a conspiracy theorist.
The first word that you can think of after you hear the word conspiracy, most people will say theory. And that's because we've all been trained to associate theory with conspiracy. So in other words, no conspiracies are real. They're all just theories. So let's define what is a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy, by definition, is when two or more people plan something in secret. All right? Theory, by definition, is a supposition, a concept, an idea. For example, in theory, if I purchase a raffle ticket, I can win a prize. Now, once I purchase a raffle ticket, it's no longer a theory. It becomes a possibility. And the more raffle tickets that I purchase, the more possible and eventually probable the win becomes. And such is the case with a conspiracy theory. When you have no evidence to support the contention of a conspiracy, then indeed it is a conspiracy theory. But once you have a piece of evidence, no matter how flimsy or circumstantial it may be, the idea of a conspiracy becomes a possibility. And the more evidence that you amass to support the contention of a conspiracy, the more probable and eventually likely that conspiracy is. So if you apply that towards the official story, I remember that on September 18th, a week after the attacks on September 11th, Condoleezza Rice did a news conference, and she stated, and I'm paraphrasing, I might be quoting her word for word, she said, "We have definitive proof and evidence that links Osama bin Laden to the attacks on September 11th, and we will release this information in due time." Now, to this day, there has never been any information released or any evidence that proves or links Osama bin Laden to the September 11th attacks. So if you apply the official story to the term conspiracy theory, they charged Osama bin Laden with a conspiracy to destroy the Twin Towers and to attack America. However, they never provided any evidence to support that contention. So by definition, that means that the official story is a conspiracy theory, because they never provided any evidence to support it. So if the official story has no evidence to support the accusation against Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, however, there is a myriad of evidence that supports the idea that this was something other than an attack by Osama bin Laden, then we have to, you know, logic and common sense would dictate that we would have to look at all of the other evidence to find out what really happened. And anybody who has been looking at this evidence, like I said, for over a decade now, a decade and a half, has been labeled as a wacko, right-wing, extremist, this and that and everything, because they do not want a lot of this information brought into the public domain, into open conversation. They just don't want it, because the official story cannot hold water.
Is that true, Ian, that there's no link with Osama bin Laden?
Very little. Even the FBI chief said that he was amazed to find 2 years later that they actually couldn't find anything, though he said there was no paper trail, even after they investigated everything they found in Afghanistan. And now, actually, the official stories subtly change, like they do, without actually telling us. And the story now is that actually it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed who's conveniently in Guantanamo Bay and been tortured, according to most reports, very seriously over a very long period, and hence worthless as a witness. So it's changed. Osama bin Laden was just the sort of godfather at the back of it. They couldn't find any connection to him. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, oh dear, he turns out to be another a friend of the West. Robert Fisk in The Independent has written that he believes he was an agent of the Pakistani intelligence in the days when Pakistani intelligence used to work closely with the CIA. So the story keeps changing, and Martin is so right. There is literally, I think I'm right in saying, there is literally no major terrorist attack where the alleged culprits haven't already had contacts with the security services of the country concerned, and where that's initially been denied. And that includes 7/7, I believe.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Very, very close contacts, actually, between the Finsbury Park Mosque and Abu Hamza, and Haroun Aswat, and MI6. John Loftus has alleged actually that Haroun Aswat was an MI6 double agent who was the mastermind of the 7/7 attacks, and he was never put on trial. Yeah. Instead, he was sent over to the United States. So they said he was mad, put him in Broadmoor, sent him over to the US, and he is now in jail after being tried for something completely different to 7/7. So that was quite a convenient way of getting him out of the way. But Martin, this term conspiracy theory, a CIA weaponized term, number 1035-690. Well, that sounds like a conspiracy theory itself, but look it up. This is actually something which the CIA developed the term to use throughout the media, in other words, to get their agents in the press to start continually using this term after the Kennedy assassination.
That's right, because what was happening after the Kennedy assassination, various people were asking questions about it, and they were being called assassination theories, theories of how the assassination had taken place. You know, could the Oswald firing from the book depository have managed to do it, etc., all those kind of questions. And the CIA decided to use strategic communications, psychological warfare, and they pushed this idea of conspiracy theory, which by definition is wacko. Tinfoil hat. That phrase came out at the same time, and this was quite consciously pushed by the CIA. They told all of their acolytes in the media to pick up on this term and to use it, and it's still used as a means of controlling public debate about terrorism and other matters related to it.
Okay, so look up that number. It's 1035-960. If you stick that into your favourite search engine, definitely not necessarily Google, that's what you'll come out with. You'll see the evidence that actually this is a term. The media has been very, very important, and as we're seeing there from the use of this term conspiracy theory in spinning the line of what is the 9/11 attacks really all about. But can you take us through what actually happened, Ian?
Well, yeah, I mean, the official story holds that quite by surprise, a bunch of highly trained terrorists showed up in America. They hijacked four planes, 19 of them, got into four teams. They hijacked four different planes, and they flew them into the two twin towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And the fourth one, there's no great consensus. Some people think it was aimed at the Capitol, which would have made it practically turned America
That's
in
the White
overnight.
House.
The White House, the Congress,
right.
Which would have turned America more or less overnight into a police state, no doubt about it, if it isn't already. But that plane was either crashed or some people think shot down. That's the official story. And pretty much every part of it is suspect. I'm not saying wrong, but they haven't produced the evidence. I mean, the most spectacular thing, of course, is the building collapses, where they still have not produced any peer-reviewed evidence that buildings can collapse in the way that those appeared to, with nothing more than relatively minor structural damage when you consider the size of the buildings, and relatively hot but not super hot fires.
Martin, what was, do you think, why are we still talking about it today, 16 years afterwards? I introduced it as a sort of, you know, almost like a young man coming of age. 16 years ago, this happened, and it's a lie, which is, many parts of which are now starting to actually take form and almost become part of the definition of what's happening in the 21st century.
It was obviously a epical event, and it, we're still talking about it because it's still very relevant to the situation we're in today. But interestingly enough, in the first few years after 9/11, the mainstream media banged on every year about it to remind us why we were going to war in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And now, in fact, they're playing it down rather, because they know that more and more questions are being asked about it, and they'd rather that people just remember it as they want it to be remembered, and that, let's move on now with that history, let's not worry about it.
Opinion polls show that Britain, France, we did what? Reinvestigate 9/11 did an opinion poll through a, you know, a reputable, normal, well-known company. I forget which one, Maury, I think. And we found about 30% of people in the UK do not believe the official story and fundamentally don't believe it. They think it's seriously wrong. Same in France. 30% of people in France think the US government organised 9/11. Similar figures in the United States. A lot of people, you know, you might meet might be very surprised to hear that, because all the people they know, you know, they read The Guardian, watch the BBC, and they believe the official story, more establishment-minded. But that is what objective opinion polls have found. There's very widespread doubts about it, even in the West.
Some people have called the smoking gun of 9/11 Building 7, and this is one of the most clearly and obvious problems with the official story, is that, first of all, to a large extent, it doesn't feature in the official story, and then where it does, we see absolutely unbelievable stories attached to it. So why Building 7? Why have people said that this is the smoking gun, Ian?
Because it's now agreed that it fell at free fall acceleration for a part of its fall, as well as falling completely symmetrically. And the 9/11 sceptics are saying, well, that can't happen through any other way than controlled demolition. You cannot have a building failure where all the support fails within a millisecond of each other and symmetrically at the same time, which is what is required to make the official story work. As I mentioned earlier, there's been no peer-reviewed evidence produced to support the official story. There's just been claims from Washington investigators. And recently, the University of Alaska has come out and said, after our studies, they're saying, we can't find any way on our computer models that we could make this happen. So it's looking like it's pretty dodgy.
Well, also the Daily Express, which is about to be, looks like maybe taken over by the Mirror, I heard this morning. Says what the headline last year, what really sent it down? Shock report reveals 9/11 tower did not collapse due to fire. So there's certainly a question we can leave hanging in the air for a few minutes. But also there is another interesting aspect to all of this, and that is that Alaska University seems to have taken this whole question of what really happened at Building 7 on with a gusto, and they've started something called it's called WTC7 evaluation, and just literally this week have released a report which again throws more doubt upon the official story. They aren't necessarily saying it was controlled demolition, but that is what many people who look at the footage say.
Yeah, I mean, my first thought, you know, because I always like to think the best of people, was that maybe there was a gas main in the buildings, you know, which blew up, but there wasn't, you know, and nobody's really produced the sort of energy you need to create that sort of destruction. And these huge, huge skyscrapers, 47 stories high, WTC7, World Trade Center 110, the sort of forces you need to demolish those buildings are immense, and yeah, nobody can really see where they came from if it wasn't some sort of explosive. And there were reports. See, I mean, one thing that has been forgotten, I think, is the testimony of William Rodriguez, who was the head janitor in the buildings, the Twin Towers. He has no doubt at all that there were massive explosions in the basements of those buildings.
Okay,
and
it's not just him, though.
There's many other people who corroborate
that. That's one of the best things, I think, in a way, about that film, In Plain Sight, I mentioned with Dave von Kleist earlier, which came out in 2004, is that he has, like, literally 2 minutes of TV, live TV coverage, where the live TV commentators are saying there are reports of explosions, we are hearing explosions, and that is something which is not really commensurate with collapsing buildings. But Martin, it's interesting, isn't it, that we've had quite a lot of academics now and architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth looking very closely at this.
Yeah, can I just repeat to people what WTC7 was? Because it was a third building that collapsed, and many people don't even realise that three buildings collapsed. And, of course, as Ian's pointed out, where is the energy to reduce buildings not to rubble but to dust? Dust! Fine particle dust.
What was it, a death ray?
Well, indeed, you've got to ask. I mean, and of course, there has been further studies by Nils Harrit and Steve Jones. Nils Harrit from Copenhagen University, Steve Jones from the University of Utah. They're chemists, and they've discovered in the rubble traces of nanothermite, which is an extremely powerful explosive. The only people who've got it are basically the United States military.
And it's called thermite because it gets extremely hot very fast.
Well, nanothermite is special because it's not even normal thermite, but they've discovered it, and it's been peer reviewed in the chemistry journals.
Only the US military, or with other people?
Well, it's going to be the US military and their allies, maybe the British and the Israelis, but nobody else.
When you mentioned the US military, let me just mention one part of the 9/11 attacks that I forgot to mention, and that is the anthrax attacks. Now, everybody was quite sure at the time that they were connected, and one reason for that was that these letters with anthrax spores and deadly anthrax spores that were sent out across America. One reason they thought that was because they had messages in them saying "Long live Allah" and onward with jihad or whatever. Well, actually, it turned out that anthrax, on forensic analysis, and this is widespread, this is agreed now by the mainstream media, that anthrax came out of a US laboratory. It didn't come out of anywhere in Iraq or Afghanistan. And once that came out, suddenly they all forgot about the anthrax attacks. And the FBI reckon they found some rogue scientist who committed suicide. You can imagine the story, But it did come out of a US laboratory, that anthrax. And so, why shouldn't the rest of 9/11 have come out of the US as well, some people are saying?
Absolutely right. Well, maybe. But anyway, before we leave Building 7 completely, I'd like to go back to the actual date of 9/11 itself. And it's probably the most embarrassing couple of minutes of TV footage the BBC have ever transmitted, because this was on BBC News 24. And their reporter was Jane Stanley. The amazing thing is, here she is reporting the collapse of the World Trade Center Building 7 several minutes. I'm not sure how many minutes. Do you know either of you two? Before it actually happened.
It was about 20 minutes, wasn't
it? About 20 minutes before it happened. Now, since this time, the BBC have said, oh, well, we just got a report from Reuters. But then the question, of course, goes to Reuters.
Well,
how did Reuters know?
Matt Campbell, who's a very heroic guy, he lost his brother tragically in the World Trade Center, and he's been campaigning off and on ever since. He's been snubbed by his MP, won't even take up his case, won't answer his questions, snubbed by the local police. Anyway, Matt did get an answer from the BBC, which was... or at least from Reuters. And he said, well, where was the source of this information? Because it's pretty important. And Reuters said, oh, well, we can't remember. That's it. They can't remember the
source. OK, mainstream media, get your act together or get out of town. Anyway, let's have a listen to BBC World News 24 from September the 11th itself, and this incredible report of Building 7 collapsing 20 minutes before it really did.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago I was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing. And indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy. There's almost a sense downtown in New York behind me, down by the World Trade Centers, of just an area completely closed off as the rescue workers try to do their job. But this isn't the first building that has suffered as a result. We know that part of the Marriott Hotel next to the World Trade Center also collapsed as a result of this huge amount of falling debris from 110 floors walls of the two twin towers of the World Trade Center. As you can see behind me, the Trade Center appears to be still burning. We see these huge clouds of smoke and ash, and we know that behind that there's an empty piece of what was a very familiar New York skyline, a symbol of the financial prosperity of this city, but completely disappeared now, and New York is still unable to take on board what has happened to them today.
Well, unfortunately, I think we've lost the line with Jane Stanley in Manhattan. Perhaps we can rejoin her and follow that up later.
Sounds quite convincing, doesn't she? Sounds like she really does know what she's talking about.
They can do that. That's part of one of the skill of working for the mainstream media, isn't it? You say something with a certain authority. It's something to do with tone of voice, I think.
Oh, yes, it's been weakened. That was the reason there. And then, of course, she gets cut off, having announced to the world that something's happened that's about to be planned to happen in a few 30 minutes' time. I can also remember in the Press Gazette, which was the weekly magazine, it used to be anyway, for journalists. So I think it's gone online only now. There was a review of the BBC's reply to that assertion that, oh, it was just a bit of confusion, nothing more than that. And the correspondent, I can't remember who it was, but the correspondent discussing it wasn't convinced at all by the BBC editor's reply, and they said, pull the other one, lizard man. Right. So that, I think, sums it up. Anyway, the Press Gazette, not long after that, was bought up by another company, and it's never really quite been the same since. And so, Martin, again, we come back to this whole thing of the press spinning it, and when the press starts to explain to journalists and the public that we're being lied to, it seems that organ, that particular part of the press, gets closed down, in that case anyway. Or at least taken over.
Daily Mirror was taken over by some New York financiers. They said the one thing we're not going to do is interfere editorially, and then they sacked Piers Morgan a year or two later because of his editorial.
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream media are very important in all of this, because if you are a criminal cabal inside the state carrying out attacks like this, and of course there's a track record of NATO intelligence services engaging in this false flag terrorism, as it's called, going back to the 1940s. So, for example,
do you want to just explain that term, false flag?
Well, false flag originally came about because in naval warfare in the 18th and 19th centuries, some ships, and the Battle of San Nazaire, for example, in the Second World War, the British commandos flew a German flag as they move towards the dock.
And of course, that's against the rules of war, is it?
It's against the rules of war, but it's the sort of thing that used to happen and still does happen. So that's where the term false flag came from. But of course, what we're really talking about here is terrorist attacks like those that happened in Italy during the 70s and the 80s, which police investigation have proved beyond a shadow of a doubt were carried out by the intelligence services of NATO. And that's said by Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who was one of the main investigators of all these incidents that went on in Italy in that era. And in other words, 9/11 didn't come out of a blue sky. NATO intelligence services have been engaging in this kind of manipulation for quite a long while.
And then, of course, we've got the issue of the sort of what you might say the period of the political planning of 9/11 in the years up to 9/11, when they realised they didn't have an enemy any longer in the form of the Soviet Union. So they said, well, we're going to make drugs and terrorism our enemies. This was all very openly discussed. Nobody thought it was that significant at the time, because it seemed very important.
Is this the neocons we're talking about here?
Well, no, we're talking about the mainstream, American Washington mainstream, UK mainstream. Remember, the UK has a huge interest in its strategic strategy of keeping America looking outwards and involved in the rest of the world. That is our plan for, and we piggyback on America. And if America's risking turning and looking inward, which it did look as if would happen in the 90s with the alleged Soviet threat over, there was a huge amount of fear that America, in Washington, London, all across NATO, that America would just lose interest in fighting wars abroad. And that was discussed very widely. They had a commission in America called the Hart-Rudman Commission, which decided that terrorism must be seen as being a huge number one enemy. That reported just before, 6 months before 9/11.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because a big ally of the United States is Israel. And, of course, a lot of the effect of 9/11 has been in the Middle East. And Benjamin Netanyahu, in the 1980s, actually wrote a book. Actually, I think he only just did one chapter. But this book was edited by Netanyahu, and it was called Terrorism, How the West Can Win.
Yeah. Well, we certainly won through using terrorism.
So. Anyway, also, I mean, one of the things I quite often hear is, well, if this was an inside job of some sort, surely there would be whistleblowers.
Well, there are. But you've got to remember, whistleblowers, they can only testify to what they know, because otherwise they're going to be called conspiracy theorists, as discussed earlier. So you're never going to get a whistleblower who's going to say, well, I can tell you what the whole plan of 9/11 was, because there might only be half a dozen people on the planet who know that. Because what you have to understand, I was discussing this with the Daily Mail actually this week, is compartmentalization. No, that is just inherent in any intelligence operation. You know, if people put explosives in the World Trade Center, they would have thought it was to protect against some sort of disaster. They wouldn't have been told, oh, well, we're going to have a false flag terrorist operation. So, you know, when Colleen Rowley, FBI agent in chief in Minneapolis, gets up and says, well, I can testify that the CIA and the FBI headquarters refused our request to arrest some of these alleged hijackers, which would have stopped 9/11. When she says that, she can't say any more than that. She can't say, and I think it was part of a plot, because they'll start laughing at her. But if you add up the various whistleblowers, then you find that, you know, depending on what you call a whistleblower, you find that there's a pretty strong consensus, you know, around the theory that the official story is wrong.
But one whistleblower goes by the name of Barry Jennings, and he was in World Trade Center Building 7, wasn't he, Martin? And he said that he was in there, and he only just about managed to get out. But he was actually an official working for the Port Authority, and he gave a couple of interviews, but then he died very suddenly. Well,
not long
quickly,
after being interviewed by the BBC Conspiracy Files programme. And when I appeared in a public event, with me and the guy who did the conspiracy files, I was told unofficially before the programme that the one thing he wouldn't discuss was his interview with Barry Jennings, which took place not long at all before Jennings was apparently died of a heart attack. He was a senior guy, very credible guy. He wasn't just an ordinary sort of random eyewitness.
Yeah, and he was actually working for them. Anyone else you'd like to point to, Martin, as regards whistleblowers? Or maybe we can even move on to some of the people that have made a real difference over the last 16 years in getting the word out. I know the first person I actually read material from about the 9/11 attacks was a guy called Thierry Masson. I'd never heard of him before.
Yes, well, he's a very well-known French journalist, and he's been based in Damascus.
Well, I haven't ever seen him on Newsnight or anything like that.
No, you wouldn't go in there.
Well, can I tell you, somebody who's very important that the listeners need to understand is General Leonid Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11.
But it's more interesting looking at the Americans, surely, because the Russians would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, no, they wouldn't.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, someone like Stubblebine, for example, he's actually a US general.
Stubblebine is the highest ranking US military figure to have questioned the story, and of course there are others. There is a very good website which I think is called Military
Patriots Question 9/11.
No, it's the Military and Intelligence Question 9/11. I can't remember what the exact title of the website is. It's just gone from my mind. But basically, it's got hundreds of US military officers who have to be officers. They're not just enlisted men. And they all question the story. But can I just come back on the Ivashov question? The Russians have a massive intelligence gathering operation, which he would have been at the centre of. And he is basically very calmly, if you look at this material, people can look him up, he's very calmly saying, we're not buying this. We're just not buying it.
One of the other big figures is a guy called David Ray Griffin. I think he's become maybe one of the most respected in the United States. He's certainly sold, hate to say it, Ian, but probably more copies
more
of his book than
me,
you.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you rate him?
No, he's great. He's got a different style from me. I write in a journalistic style, and he sort of is a bit more polemical. He's making a case. He gives you the points. And he makes his case, you know, most people think who've read him.
I prefer to report,
you know, what people are saying rather than particularly make a case one way or the other.
He's just come out with a new book, actually, David Ray Griffin, and it's called Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. How's that for a cheery title? But I think he's saying that there is information coming out all the time about the September the 11th attacks, and much of it has been missed. And one of the things he's trying to do with these books, as he brings new books out, is to make sure that there's almost a chapter by chapter, okay, here's another 200 pages of evidence as to why they're lying to us. But anyway, here is an interview just from a couple of weeks ago by a guy called John Such in the US at KBOO radio station in Portland with David Ray Griffin about this book. And one of the things he focuses on is the movements of Dick Cheney on the day.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the new things in the book is about Cheney. According to the official story, he was in his office and then he was taken downstairs by the Secret Service, but he didn't really get into the room down there till I think it was 9:58. Well, the fact was that Cheney went down there very early. The mainstream press pretty much ignored all the evidence, including one member of the cabinet who said, no, Dick Cheney was down there certainly before 9:30 and certainly before the Pentagon was struck. But the reason for the lie about this was that that way they could claim that Cheney could not have been responsible for the attack on the Pentagon. Well, in the book, I've summarized new evidence that showed that there were at least three major statements by members of the Secret Service who were there and involved in 9/11 who said that Cheney was into the room before 9:30. I mean, this is a blockbuster story potentially for the press to say his story about 9/11 that shows that Cheney lied and the 9/11 Commission lied about where Cheney was. And this has been available for over a year, and you not have a single mainstream report about this. It all goes back to empire. These are all things to support America's dominance of the world, and therefore of its natural resources.
I'm also a member of Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, and part of my reason was I just felt we've been blaming the wrong people for a horrendous crime. And if there's anything that is a sin throughout all of our religious traditions, it certainly is bearing false witness.
You know, it's the greatest false flag operation ever, both in terms of the size of the operation and in the size of the effects. So that's another way of describing what my book is about. What have been the effects of the 9/11 false flag attacks?
Well, there's another group for you, Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth. We've heard about Martin and his military leaders, but I think it's fair to say that people like Richard Gage and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have been some of the real spearhead, I suppose, of the official response to the attacks, Ian.
Well, there's two sides to this, basically, if you distill it. There's the forensic side, which is how did the towers come down, what happened to the plane that seems to have vanished at the Pentagon, some people say, that sort of side of it. And then you've got what I would call the paper trail side, which is the alleged hijackers were being protected by the CIA and financed by the Saudis. That's something we haven't really touched on yet. But this is very big in America. There's a guy in the New York Post who's provided the most devastating evidence that the Saudi government was, in a sense, behind 9/11.
But that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Especially since the Saudis and the Americans have got a very important strategic and financial connection.
Well, it's not only strategic and financial, but who was it who blocked the FBI from arresting those Saudi-supported hijackers? Not the Saudis. They can't block investigations in America. It was the CIA. It was our friends at the Osama bin Laden unit, which nobody even knew about at the time of 9/11. 2 years later, the Daily Telegraph broke the news, and they mentioned also very significantly that the Osama bin Laden unit was a secret unit, and it was in secret premises. It wasn't even a CIA, because of course the first reaction of anybody in the CIA, if you mention this to them, is they'll say, oh well, you couldn't keep it secret. That's the other thing we we've all heard so many times, isn't it? You couldn't keep it secret. Well, maybe that's why they put the Osama bin Laden in a top secret unit in a top secret location. We still don't know what that location was, but we do know from the 9/11 Commission report, reading between the lines, they never admitted it in so many words, that there were about 80 people in that team. 80.
Experts speak out, Martin. This is a film, last year I think it came out, certainly within the last couple of years. It's really pretty devastating evidence from professional architects and professional engineers about the collapse of the World Trade Center.
Yes, and I think even if you're not a specialist, you can ask yourself a simple question. If three skyscrapers can collapse into their own footprints and be reduced not to rubble but to dust by fires, then maybe we should not be building buildings like this at all. Why haven't we closed down all the skyscrapers? Why, you know, you'd think that's what you'd
do. This is where we go to Grenfell Tower,
of course. Yes, Grenfell Tower burned for hours, but it didn't collapse. And in fact, there's been a number of fires in skyscrapers since then, all over the world. There was one in Madrid that burned for 2 days, I think. And the skyscrapers are designed not to collapse when they're on fire.
I think we can give you... you know, a bit of an exclusive here. There's a secret war going on in the Fire Brigades Union around this very issue. Mm-hmm. Because a year or two before Grenfell Tower, 9/11 truthers in the Fire Brigades Union, of which there are quite a few and increasingly many now, they said, hang on, if the official story of 9/11 is true, the authorities have behaved as if it's not true, because the policy is still to stay put in a fire. And if it's true that buildings can collapse just like that, just because of a fire, then the policy should be not to actually get people out as quickly as possible. Fire Brigades Union executive, purely out of political correctness and not wanting to get the CIA and who else on their backs, refused to discuss this. And now, as a result, you could say, indirectly, you know, we had the disaster in Grenfell Tower, where still people were told to stay rather than get out.
Well, let's move on to talk about some of the potential motives. Maybe you first, Martin. What do you think's the motives? We heard a little bit, didn't we, from David Ray Griffin there.
Well, I think it's pretty... I mean, if you look at the past history of false flag attacks by NATO intelligence services, going back to the... what was it called? The... In 1964, the Northwoods... Operation Northwoods. It's people can look this up quite straightforwardly these days. You can check any of the things we're saying on this show. Operation Northwoods was a plan by Lyman Lemnitzer, who is the head of the U.S. military.
Oh, and Bilderberger, by the way.
It was signed off by all the U.S. military
chiefs. It's a small world, isn't it?
And basically, what the plan was, there were going to be hijackings of planes, and there were going to be bombs going off. Lots of people would seem to have been killed inside the United States. They would then blame Cuba for everything that had happened and invade Cuba. And there's a whole plan written down, which was passed to Kennedy and to Robert McNamara, his sidekick, to and they just threw it back at them and said, we're not doing that, that's crazy. But in other words, there's a long history...
And then, hang on, because you missed out... Then Kennedy was assassinated.
Well, yeah. That subsequently happened. I presume most of our listeners will know that. But the fact is that Operation Gladio, for example, in Western Europe in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and up to now, there is overwhelming evidence that NATO has engaged in false flag terrorism long before 9/11. The Bologna bombing was in 1980. The Italian police investigated that and they came to an absolutely firm conclusion that their own intelligence services were behind the bombing, which killed 86 people. So it was a bigger bombing than the 7/7 bombings in London. And that's proven. Nobody's ever been arrested. Nobody's ever been put on trial. And because nobody's ever been arrested or put on trial for these things, we can presume that they're still active within the intelligence services. And so when we think of MI5 and MI6 and CIA, they are not there to protect the people. They're just not. They haven't been for years.
Before we hear from Ian Henshaw on what he thinks the motives for September the 11th attacks really were, let's have a go back again to Dave von Kleist, who did this film back in 2004 called 9/11 in Plain Sight, and was a radio host doing a regular radio show over in the United States for many years, and he was one of the first people, I suppose, that turned me and others, many others, onto the so-called conspiracy theories. Actually, really, what we are is conspiracy scholars. We know it was a conspiracy. We're just trying to work out exactly who, how, and why. But what does he think about what the motives were?
Now, if you turn the clock back to, say, 1999, let's ask ourselves the question, how many world powers were there? Well... Russia had collapsed back in the 80s, so that wasn't really a threat anymore. China was the U.S. biggest trading partner. So of all the world powers out there, which one of them posed a threat to the United States? What the answer is, none of them. So, okay, let's keep that idea in mind. Then ask yourself the question, what is the biggest business in the world? Some people would come back and say the oil business. Some people would say big pharma. Okay. The point is that the biggest business includes all of them, because the biggest business in the world is the military-industrial complex, military contracting. If you look at the situation back in the late 90s, in 99, the United States lusts for war. I mean, 52% of our federal budget in this country goes towards the military-industrial complex, and people are making obscene amounts of money by military contracts. So the point is that if there's no threat of military action or conflict in the world, these people are not feeling very financially secure. Okay, so if you put that idea in the back burner, now let's add something else. Back in 99, the Trade Center was owned by the Port Authority. The Port Authority had been informed by the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, that the World Trade Center's buildings were dirty buildings. In other words, they were loaded with asbestos. They were built in the late 60s, early 70s. And the only way to remove asbestos is to strip the building right down to its girders and sandblast this stuff off. You can't do it like, say, 5 or 10 floors at a time. The whole building has to be done. So it would not have been cost effective to both of those towers down to their girders and then rebuild them. It's just impossible to do. Financially impossible. So then the EPA had told them, say, hey, look, if it's not done within 10 years, we're going to have to condemn it and shut the building down. So, number one, military contractors lust for war. Number two, there's no threat of war in the late 90s. Number three, the EPA had told the Port Authority that they had to do something about these buildings. Okay? So, number four, if the military-industrial complex lusts for war and there's no prospect for war, how can they generate a war? Okay? Do you see where we're going with this? We're looking for a motive. We're looking for opportunity. Okay? The point is that the powers that be had the motive to destroy these buildings. There's no way they could have brought them down like they do in Las Vegas after a hotel has outlived its usefulness, or someplace in the country where a sports stadium has to be brought down, or an apartment building. They hire a controlled demolition company and bring it down. But they couldn't do that in New York. I mean, we're talking Wall Street. If anybody's ever been to Wall Street, you know how congested and how close together all these buildings are. There's no way that the Trade Center could be raised or blown up and brought down. So what were they going to do? How could they possibly get rid of these two towers that have turned into albatrosses? Oh, there's another factor to put into this. According to William Rodriguez, who was working the Trade Center for 20 years, 35% of the office space was vacant. So the Trade Center was losing millions and millions and millions of dollars every month. So they're losing money. They've got a dirty building. They lust for war. How many other motivating factors do you need to motivate somebody to have a false flag and blame it on the Middle East and justify a move into the Middle East? And you put that together with another issue that happened back in 2000 before George W. Bush was elected president, was the Project for the New American Century. This was a think tank that consisted of Paul Bremer, Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, of course George Bush, all of the same cabal that was in the administration. And they said in that document, it said that they wanted to be able to control the Middle Eastern oil, but they needed an excuse to go into the Middle East, and it would be nothing other than, and I quote, a Pearl Harbor type of an event to justify military action. So I realize that a lot of this information, a lot of these points that I'm making are circumstantial. None of it is hard evidence. But if you put them all together, you come up with some very strong motivation to want these towers to be destroyed. But they couldn't do it legally. They couldn't do it in the open. So how would they do it? Well, how convenient. We'll have a terrorist attack, blow the buildings up and blame it on the Middle East, and that'll give us a justification to launch a war.
That's Dave von Kleist again there. Ian Henschel, also, he mentioned the idea of New Pearl Harbor. That's also the book, isn't it? One of the first, in fact, the first big book by David Ray Griffin. This is a New Pearl Harbor, the idea being that if America's under threat like it was in 1941 with the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor, suddenly the people will do almost anything.
Yeah, well, if throughout the whole of the Second World War, you know, if you said, why are we bothering to talk about Pearl Harbor? People would have thought you were crazy. That's why we were in the war. And unfortunately, with 9/11, the war's gone on for 15 years. And the reason we're talking about 9/11 is because that's why we're in this war, basically. And they keep on using it. You know, I think the reason a lot of us got involved with campaigning for the truth is was because we could see that they were going to be using this for a long time. You know, this wasn't going to be an issue that was going to go away anytime soon.
Martin, a lot of the mainstream left, for example, the Stop the War Coalition, for example, don't really think that 9/11 is important.
Well, I think what you're going to find is something like the Stop the War Coalition is an anti-war coalition. Let's just say the official story is true and a bunch of people in a cave in Afghanistan brought these buildings down. That still doesn't justify invading Iraq and killing millions of people. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
So you've got to separate the two things out. People don't have to believe all the things we're talking about to oppose war. War's wrong. War's evil. We don't need war.
You know what? It's a bit like the climate change argument, isn't it? Where you say, well, I don't have to believe in climate change to know that we need less cars.
Yeah, that's right.
So we shouldn't attack people. If people are opposed to war, that's fine. I mean, they don't have to believe all the things we're talking about. If they're opposed to war, that's good in itself. But, of course, the real problem is that this is... You know, this has been done quite deliberately to create a war, and it's a war without end. Unlike the Second World War, which had a definite end, this has got no end. It's going to go on forever.
The Second World War was 6 years, wasn't it? Six years long, and we've had what's that? Nearly three Second World Wars now.
I think where I would take issue with some people on the left, particularly the mainstream left, somebody like George Monbiot, sadly, I think he sadly discredited himself with his savage attack on the 9/11 truth movement, which unfortunately most Guardian readers wouldn't have known was based on pretty much totally incorrect facts.
Well, many of his Guardian readers don't know that his father was the vice chairman of the Conservative Party.
I didn't know that.
But anyway, reinvestigate 9/11.
I run it nowadays with lots of help from some great people. Roy Hunter, I don't know how many to mention. I should have got their permission perhaps before. So I'm the public face of it. Yeah, we're the British version of the 9/11 truth movement, we'd like to think. You know, we've got a website, reinvestigate911.org. You can sign up to our newsletter. You won't get bombarded just a few times a year, probably. And we've got a demo outside the BBC on Monday in Portland's place in London. We're hoping to get some coverage.
Surely you should be trying to persuade the BBC on side rather than having a go at them.
Well, we've tried.
Is there not going to be a documentary on the BBC exposing some of this?
No, they won't. I mean, the demand is that they should correct the information, vitally important information that they put out in their Conspiracy Files programmes, which turned out to be absolutely false. They expressly denied that World Trade Center 7 collapsed at free fall speed because, of course, they could see that was game, set and match to the to us. If they were to admit that. But since then, Washington's been forced to admit that. They haven't taken any notice of the implications, but they have been forced to admit it. But the BBC still won't. BBC have acted as, I'm afraid to say, launderers for the official story.
We'll be back after the Murdoch News at 6.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.